If it seems like Americans are intensely divided along partisan lines that show no signs of intersecting, it may be because we've forgotten the core of American consensus. The idea that there's always been a tension between individual freedom in America and the need for community. That's according to our guest this hour, E.J. Dionne Jr., whose new book is called Our Divided Political Heart. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. E.J. Dionne Jr. is a columnist for The Washington Post. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and his new book is called Our Divided Political Heart. And we welcome your take this hour. Is the balance between individualism and community at the core of how America works? How did the balance break, and what can we do to bring it back? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@WPR.org. And E.J. Dionne, welcome.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start with a quote from the beginning of your book. You write that, I believe that Americans are more frustrated with politics and with ourselves than we have to be, more fearful of national decline than our actual position in the world or our difficulties would justify, and less confident than our history suggests we should be. Now, that's a pretty optimistic quote that you've got there, an optimistic point of view. Where does that optimism come from?
Well, the optimism comes from the idea that we have, A, as a country, gone through some very bitter struggles before. This isn't the first time we were at each other's throats over politics. Sometimes it really got bad in the 1850s that eventually led to the Civil War. I don't think we're at that point yet. And yet, historically, I think we've always rediscovered our balance. My favorite quotation about America is from Winston Churchill, who once said, Americans always do the right thing after first exhausting all of the other possibilities. And I think we tend to do that. And the book actually begins with, I was grateful you read that particular quote, because the first sentence of the book is about American decline. And I think we have been, our politics has been defined by an underlying fear of decline for the last 5, 6, 7 years. I think it's one of the reasons, oddly, why President Obama won. Because when we go through these periods of decline, we initially say it has to do with economics or foreign policy, but quickly it turns into a spiritual crisis. And when you think back to the Obama campaign, those posters with the single word hope on them, or the change we can believe in slogan, I've always thought that word believe was more important than the word change. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of, he spoke to that crisis. Now, the reason I'm optimistic is because, as you nicely said at the beginning of the show, the book argues that there is a tension, but a healthy tension, that has defined us as Americans from the very beginning of the Republic, between our love of individualism and our quest for and affection for community. And it's not like we're divided between individualists and communitarians. All of us have both tendencies within us. And I think at the moment, we're at a time where a lot of folks in politics, I think particularly a new brand of conservatism, has forgotten this community common good side of us, has forgotten that in our history, government played a major role in building up the country. It wasn't all-powerful government. We always want to keep government in check, but we also want to keep concentrated private power in check. And my optimism comes from the fact that I think this consensus, this balance is so strong in us that I think it keeps finding a way to reassert itself. And it is, in the end, a kind of common sense consensus that I think most people at some level or other relate to.
So if we have these two twin strands making up the American character, this love of community and this American individualism, how did such a central tenet of our character get lost if we become to think of ourselves as one or the other?
Well, there are two reasons for this. One is the Tea Party, although it's odd in the book. The book is obviously, from what I've said, critical of the Tea Party's view, although at the beginning of the book, I thank the Tea Party for opening this debate about American history, and I think people who are politically progressive or liberal need to embrace the American story at least as much as our friends in the Tea Party do, because I think ultimately, when you look at the progress the country has made, this is our history is a progressive history. But I think there was also a stream of academic thought that said liberal individualism, that's liberal in the old sense, not in the conventional sense today, is the one and only defining characteristic of our country. Liberty is very easy to talk about. Community is more complicated because it exists at various levels. People define it in different ways. But I always like to point out to people that the very first word of the American Constitution is the word we, the people of the United States. And the Constitution in the preamble describes a whole series of common goals that we need to achieve in order to reach the result that the framers call for. The Declaration of Independence begins with a ringing call for individual liberty, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And it ends with a commitment by the founders to making common cause. We pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. They knew that they couldn't achieve the goals at the beginning without working together, without some sense of solidarity. And so I think that the community strand often gets lost, but it's always there.
I want to tease apart what we mean by community a little bit more. So when we use that word community in your argument, are we talking sort of about the ideas of a collectivism and government in specific, or are we talking about something less distilled than that?
You know, it's funny that you ask that question because when I was writing the book, my editor and I had very long conversations on how important it was to try to distinguish between community and government. And yet, it was also important to show how government itself in a free country, in a democratic country, is often the only way the will of the community expresses itself. So community includes everything on the one hand from, PTAs, boys clubs, girls clubs, mother's groups, reading groups, or, sports. Sports for kids are all kinds of local forms of community. Veterans groups are another famous one in our history. But community also can exist at the national level. And I think one of the arguments between left and right, which I view as a productive argument as against so many of the other kinds of arguments we have these days, is, what is the national government's role in fostering local community? Conservatives often say the federal government saps the power of local communities. I argue in the book that the federal government has often been a source of strength for local communities. When we passed the GI Bill, it was pushed for by the American Legion. The GI Bill in turn strengthened veterans organizations. A program like the Corporation for Community Service finances all sorts of service opportunities at the most local level, in churches and neighborhood groups and in homeless shelters. And so I think there is an interaction between government and community.
Do we need to agree maybe then for this balance to come to be restored about the virtues of community at all its levels? Because right now it sort of seems as though the argument has been divided into whether you believe a government hinders life and that pursuit of happiness, and it would be better to be minimalized, or whether you believe in sort of more government to be involved in the lives for a force of good.
Right. Well, one of the fun things about writing this book was to sort of retake an excursion through American history, and if you, I think there's a tendency to believe that government, in particular the national government, did not become a really important part of American life until the progressives came along under Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, or the New Deal came along. What I point out in the book is that if you go all the way back to the beginning, particularly to, say, Alexander Hamilton and Henry Clay, you see the federal government playing a vital role in building up the country, in turning us into an industrial power, in building the roads and bridges and canals that brought us together under Lincoln, and creating the land-grant colleges, which became our great state universities, particularly in the Midwest, that you see that this idea that government was kind of irrelevant to us is mistaken. I think our friends in the Tea Party look back to what I see as an exceptional period in American history, the Gilded Age, from roughly the end of the Civil War till Teddy Roosevelt's ascension to the presidency in 1901, that really was a period of radical individualism. It was a period when the Supreme Court declared that corporations are people, issued a whole bunch of decisions constricting the ability of government to balance off the private sector. And I think the progressives and the populists came along not to create something brand new, although they were innovative. But in many ways, they were restoring this balance that was created by Hamilton, Clay, Lincoln, and many others in the early part of our story. Just one of the favorite things I ran across. You know, you ask yourself the question, when was the first federal health care program passed? The answer turns out to be 1798, 10 years after the adoption of the Constitution. President John Adams signed into law a bill that created a whole system of health care hospitals for injured and sick seamen. Now, I don't know how powerful the seamen's lobby was at the time or what people were worried about, but we actually had socialized medicine for seamen in 1798. So the notion that government has sort of disappeared from American life until the New Dealers came along is simply wrong. And that's one of the points of the book, is to look at our history whole and not look at it in fragments.
Well, and you also point out that our forefathers created a strong centralized government and didn't create it to be ineffectual.
Right. In fact, the Constitution was written as an alternative to the Articles of Confederation. If you take Rick Perry, governor of Texas, when he was running for president, famously said that I think the quotation was, "I want the federal government to be as inconsequential in your life as possible." That's the government of the Articles of Confederation. The founders said this is not a strong enough government to secure the public interest or to protect the values that we want to protect, or to run the country and turn us into a viable economy. So they wrote a strong constitution. My chapter on the Constitution is called One Nation Conceived in Argument. And I think we have a tendency to put the founders on such a pedestal that we act as if the Constitution were divine tablets handed down to us, when in fact the Constitution was, and I say this with great respect, a political document. It was based on a whole series of compromises, including compromises we now would say were not good to make, like as on slavery. But it was the way they created this government. It was also a document of competing values. They wanted a strong government, but they didn't want it to be overbearing. They wanted it to accomplish certain things. But they didn't want it to get in the way of the liberties that people took for granted. And I think the founders we should look at not as people who were trying to write a document that would put us in chains 200 years later so that we couldn't solve our problems. These were very adventurous people who were doing something that the world didn't think was possible, which was creating a system of self-government as against monarchy. And so I think we should admire the founders not for writing a perfect document that is clear on everything, but rather for having a spirit of adventure that understood that freedom and democratic government required innovation in every generation.
The schism that we're talking about between individualism on the one hand and community on the other, is that something that's in its intensity? Is that unique to the time that we're in right now? Or have we seen this same sort of argument flare up with this much rancor at other times in history?
There are peculiarities of our time, I think, that come from the power of the media, the power of television. In some ways, this is in your face in ways that it wasn't before. But the answer is yes, we've had struggles like this. In the book I have a chapter on the populist movement. And I think the populists were very important and have to be seen in tandem with the progressives. That movement arose in the Midwest, in particular in the Farm Belt in the Midwest, because the country really was rebelling against the power of the new corporations who seemed to be taking control of the government, who rejected any attempt to ease the lives of ordinary people, whether on the farms or in the factories. And there were bitter struggles. There were bitter labor struggles. There was violence. I mean, it leading up to finally the victory of the progressives, when people like Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson said, we must check the power of concentrated economic entities. We have to do that in order to preserve democracy. There are some quotations from Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson that would have sounded apposite at Occupy Wall Street rallies. Wilson, for example, talked about his fear that the power of finance would become greater than that of democratic government itself. So we have been in struggles like this before. It is the source of the optimism or the hopefulness that underlies the book, that we have been here and we've gotten through it.
Well, and not to point fingers in the face of your optimism, but who is to blame for it becoming so deeply divided right now?
Well, my view is that something has happened to American conservatism that I view as unfortunate, and some of your callers will be able to call back and we can argue about that because they'll probably disagree with me on this. But I think American conservatism historically had a lively sense of community. Indeed, Robert Nisbet, the great conservative writer, argued that conservatism arose in rebellion against liberal individualism. And conservatives link tradition with community. And conservatives have never been, on the whole, as completely rejectionist, if I may use that word, of government as they are right now. And certainly Republicans have not been in this position. I quote a well-known, at the time, liberal Republican Senator Jacob Javits at some length, who talks about the roots of American republicanism and conservatism as lying in the politics of Hamilton, Clay, Lincoln, and Teddy Roosevelt. The conservatives right now are rejecting even the idea that there is such a thing as compassionate conservatism. And Bill Buckley, who was certainly a conservative and a hero to many conservatives, one of the last books he wrote in his life was a book called Gratitude, where he talked about what we owed back to a society that had nurtured and protected us. So I think you've seen a kind of radicalization on the right, the adoption of a radical form of individualism as opposed to the traditional tempered American individualism. And I am very respectful in the book, or I try to be. My conservative friends, I'll see what they have to say about it. But some of them have seen that in reading the book. I'm respectful of the conservative tradition. I just don't like the path that it has taken in recent years. And I'm hoping they come back to a more balanced form of conservatism.
So if the economy was doing well right now, and if Americans had jobs and money in their pocket, would we be having this conversation?
I think we'd be having this conversation, but I don't think we'd be having quite so many bitter arguments. It is a simple fact that when we have money in our pockets and work to do, we tend to be less angry at each other. And that shouldn't surprise us. But I think in terms of the argument of the book, I think we've been building up to this for a long time. I trace some of it back to the Goldwater campaign back in 1964, some of it back to the Clinton administration. I think one of the striking things is that both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama were very aware that liberalism itself needed a kind of communitarian correction, that sometimes liberals also speak only in terms of individual rights and forget their communitarian side. Bill Clinton gave a great speech once where he suggested that you take a penny out of your pocket. And he said on the one side of the penny is the word liberty. And on the other side are the words e pluribus unum, out of many one. Hmm. And he argued that the humble penny, the most humble piece of currency that we have, really reflected this inner balance in the United States. Conservatives used to believe passionately in community. And I think in some ways they pulled away from it as liberals embraced it. I was hoping at one point in my life that we might come closer to consensus as liberals recognize the importance of community and conservatives recognize the importance of government in, achieving that. And we would argue about a lot of things still. And I think that long consensus, by the way, is what made us very successful from the progressives all the way through in some ways to Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, because Reagan didn't try to overturn the long consensus. His rhetoric was very tough, but he governed in a much more moderate way than today's conservatives say they want to govern now.
Our guest this hour is E.J. Dionne Jr. He's a columnist for The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And we're discussing his new book today. It's called Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent, talking about this schism that we see right now in Washington and in our own homes, our own communities, between individual freedom in America and the need for community. And the individualism he's talking about has been embraced and championed by the Tea Party. And we're talking about what has happened and where we're going next. And I do want to also say that EJ will be speaking and reading from his book on Saturday, June 16th at 2 o'clock at Barnes & Noble, Westtown. So you can catch him there in person. And we want to know what you think about this. Is this balance between individualism and community the core of how America works and the secret of our success in the past? And why do you think it has come out of balance, if you agree with that? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can send your email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert with you today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we talk with our guest, E.J. Dionne Jr., columnist for The Washington Post, and he's got a new book out called Our Divided Political Heart, talking about these two twin strands of the American character, the American core, individualism on the one hand and the need for community on the other hand, and how these things didn't used to be so divided, that they used to be a common core that we agreed upon as a nation. And we will take our first caller now. We have Linda joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Linda.
Good morning. Thank you for this important discussion. I would say I'm about 67 years old, and I would say that I have been a Democratic-type socialist all my life, and I feel that the community should outweigh individual rights, or I have had faith in the government to protect individual rights. But I have to say that I don't feel the government is working in our best interests anymore because of the huge role of lobbyists. And it not only crushes individualism, but it's crushing communities as well. And the banks, Senator Durbin from Illinois said the banks own Congress, the utilities, the fossil fuel industry. They're not working in our best interest, and not to mention the military-industrial complex, which has been, I would say, over the course of my lifetime, running America into the ground. Would you address how we can look to the government to assist the common interest when we're so subject to lobbyists?
Okay. Thank you so much, Linda. And EJ?
Thank you. One of the reasons I love doing Wisconsin Public Radio is because the range of callers is so enormous, from thoughtful Democratic Socialists all the way to thoughtful Libertarians. So thank you for – it's true, and I thank you for that call. A couple of things about that. One is I talk quite a bit in the book about the Citizens United decision and the tilt in our politics toward big money. I actually have a column, my Washington Post column today – is a kind of slightly tongue-in-cheek but also half-serious proposal, or maybe it ends up having to be a serious proposal, where at this point the only people who can save us from one group of billionaires in this campaign is another group of billionaires. And I suggest that a few public-regarding millionaires announced that they're going to put up they're going to match every dollar spent on the other side just to make all this big money irrelevant to our politics. And it's sad that it's come to that, for the time being, we have to rely on millionaires to do that. I think there are a number of things we can do. I think Citizens United, a terrible decision, should be overturned somehow, possibly through constitutional amendment. I'd love to see Justice Kennedy sort of admit that he didn't see what was coming when he was the decisive vote for Citizens United. The other thing I talk about in the book is what we've seen under President Obama is not only the rise of Wall Street, but also the rise of the Tea Party, but also the rise of Occupy Wall Street. And what's funny is the Tea Party was there saying government is too powerful, government messed everything up. On the Occupy side, and people to the left of center like the caller, the anger at government was not that it acted too much, but that it failed to act in the public interest, that it fell off on the need to regulate the financial system. And I think this second wave of protests speaks to this paradox, which is, I think there are many Americans, there's a group of Americans who are frustrated with government, but they're frustrated with government not because they look upon it as always acting in a progressive fashion, but because they look at it as falling down on its job in certain areas. And I think you've seen some correction in that in the last several years. The Dodd-Frank bill is a partial correction of that period of deregulation. But I think we need a new campaign money system. What I am in favor of is a system where you would have a large public match to small contributions. You might even finance it with a tax on lobbyists, where if you gave $200 or less, there would be a match of 5 to 1 of that $200. Another way to do it might be to give vouchers, $25, $30, $50 vouchers to every American to give to political campaigns. The notion is we need to democratize the power of money in our politics. It was a cause of the progressives when the first restrictions on corporate giving were passed way back in 1907. It's an issue that's come around again.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Linda. Appreciate it. And we'll go on next to Tyler in Oshkosh. Hi, Tyler.
Hi. I'm calling in regards to just the idea of community involvement and civic involvement. In the early 1800s, when de Tocqueville came to the U.S., the French writer, and observed our society and wrote Democracy in America, he was very impressed with the amount of social and civic involvement that citizens had in, you know, intellectual groups and civic groups, just general civic and social engagement. If he were to come to our country today, do you think he may get a sense that some citizens feel more isolated or less inclined to participate in things with their fellow citizens? And I'll take my answer off the air. It's a great show.
Okay, thanks, Tyler.
Thank you so much. Tocqueville is also an important person in my story, a remarkable observer of the United States. Incidentally, he is the one of my sources of optimism. Tocqueville also saw that our capacity for self-correction was one of the greatest American gifts. But the caller described Tocqueville very well in his view of us. He was one of the first observers to notice how Americans have this rough and ready sense of community where we didn't even think about it. We didn't kind of have a theory about it. We just acted upon it at the local level. And I wonder if Tocqueville now, I think on the one hand, he would continue to see an awful lot of engagement. I mean, went through a very bitter experience in Wisconsin on that recall, but you cannot say that you were a people disengaged from politics. There was certainly enormous engagement in that fight. If you look at the local level, there still is an awful lot of community at the local level. My kids have played an enormous amount of travel sports of various kinds, baseball, soccer. Fortunately for them, they got all their athletic talent from their mother and not from me. But you see a lot of community building at that level. But I think Tocqueville would also see what Robert Putnam, the famous author of Bowling Alone, that book about the decline of social capital, I think he would see some regression from what he saw at his time, some pulling back. Some of it has to do with the power of television and other newer forms of media. But the bottom line is that I think there is a sort of snapback going on, particularly among younger Americans who, at the end of my book, they are my, they are people who make me very hopeful about the future. Because if you look at sort of the generation under 30 or under 35, there is an enormous amount of civic volunteer engagement in that group. You have seen, at least through the 2008 election, an increase in political involvement in that group. So I think that the next generation up shows to me, and I try to use figures and not just sort of hortatory, I love these guys kind of rhetoric, but a lot of numbers to show that I think this generation could become like the greatest generation that came back from World War II that built an enormous amount of social capital in the country. So the under 35s actually give me a lot of hope for the country.
All right. Well, Tyler, appreciate that call. And moving next to Jenna. Jenna joins us from Milwaukee. Hey, Jenna.
Hi. Thank you for this show. I think this is a really important topic to discuss. Part of my concern is how people really believe that democracy is going to be maintained when we allowed Citizen United to happen. And when people haven't risen up and said Citizen United is not acceptable, super PACs that have are protected and tax-free entities where people can essentially hide money, which essentially goes to corrupt our political system and our politicians and further divide wedges in communities, how they think that this is acceptable and is going to move us forward. This is absolutely not going to move us forward. And also, the ability of that money to be funneled into certain agendas, like ALEC agendas, and how people don't realize, I mean, the rhetoric within the Tea Party, they don't even realize that nobody cares about them. Really, the Tea Party is a movement to try to preserve wealth for a certain percentage of people and to pass policy that benefits a very small percentage of people. And I don't understand how they don't get that.
All right. Thank you, Jenna. And a lot to chew on there, EJ.
Indeed. And in our divided political heart, just to sneak the title of my book in again, I talk a lot about this problem. And I actually think that the polling certainly suggests that the vast majority of Americans do not like what Citizens United did. They do not like unlimited corporate contributions. It's also, by the way, said there could be unlimited union contributions, although there's more money coming from the corporate side. They don't like the idea of billionaires buying all this influence. And I think it's common sense that when one side can own the microphone, there's a real problem for free speech. When one side has the capacity to either set or come very close to setting the terms of a debate, it's hard to have a fair debate on any question. And so I think there is a lot of opposition to Citizens United in the country. A lot of people feel just as that caller does. It's very hard to overturn a decision of the United States Supreme Court. I think you've got an interesting case. You've got resistance going on in different ways. One is the state of Montana that has said its old laws against corporate influence on politics, which went back to the time when people of Montana felt that the railroads owned their legislature, so they passed laws restricting their power to buy political influence. The Supreme Court of the state of Montana essentially defied the U.S. Supreme Court and said, well, they may have made this decision, but we're making a decision for Montana. That case is working its way back up. I would love to see, as I said earlier, Justice Kennedy change his mind on this. But there are a lot of things you can do around Citizens United to try to repair the system. One is a new, as I said earlier, to match smaller contributions to try to drown the big money with small money. The other is certain disclosure rules. I mean, if all this big money is bad, it's even worse that much of it can be given secretly. And so you don't even know who's buying the election on behalf of whom. And I think even within the framework of Citizens United, there are things we can do about that. But I want the caller to express his outrage and organize more of it, because I think we should be angry about Citizens United.
Yeah, we heard this week how a public opinion of the Supreme Court took a dive after Citizens United, which is interesting. And I wonder if you could tell us how that would work if Justice Kennedy changed his mind.
Well, this has happened before. I mean, we had the Plessy v. Ferguson decision back in 1896 that said separate but equal was okay. And then in Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, the Supreme Court said, whoops, that was a mistake. The Dred Scott decision, the pro-slavery decision that Lincoln ran his campaign on, rendered a dead letter. Unfortunately, in that case, it took a civil war to settle the question. So the court has reversed itself before. The court people have decided that the courts have made wrong decisions. And there are, to be fair about it, conservatives don't like all the decisions more progressive courts have made. So we can have this battle. In the book, I argue that there's something of a set of bookend cases from Bush v. Gore at the beginning of the last decade to Citizens United at the end of the last decade. And one of the things that bothered me about Bush v. Gore, beyond the idea of just blocking a recount of ballots, which seems to me always a better way to settle disputes than having Supreme Court judges decide who is going to win an election, is there was a deep anti-democratic undertone in that decision, where they said, well, basically, the people don't really have a right to choose a president anyway, because under the Constitution, the legislatures can pick electors. And that just ignored about 150 years of democratic development, where we decided as a country we're going to keep this, I think, outdated system of having an electoral college, but at least we're going to have the electors chosen by the people. And so I think both decisions reflect a kind of anti-democratic turn, small-d democratic turn in the court that's similar to what the Gilded Age courts did.
Well, we're talking this hour with E.J. Dionne Jr., columnist for The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He has a new book out, and it's called Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. And at the core of this book is this idea that there have been these two traits in the American character and the way the American political system worked, individualism and community, and that the tension has gotten deeper and more rancorous, and that's why our system isn't working right now. So we're talking about that this hour, and we want to know what you think at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, keeping you company today. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn this week as we talk with our guest, E.J. Dionne Jr., who's got a new book out called Our Divided Political Heart. And by the way, if you want to hear him speaking and reading from that book, you can catch him on Saturday, June 16th at 2 o'clock at Barnes & Noble, Westtown. And we go now back to the phones and have Kathleen with us from Madison. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello. I'm 59 years old. I remember America in the 1980s. Severe budget cuts were made at the expense of people with disabilities, single-parent families, and the elderly. America was invading other countries, and people were being laid off of their jobs constantly. The president was Ronald Reagan. He was extremely popular among the majority of Americans. The divide, in a way, might be a good thing because it means Americans are waking up. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the call, Kathleen. EJ?
Well, as a political matter, I mean, I'm on the progressive side of politics. I disagreed with those cuts, too, a lot of those cuts as well. And there were layoffs, and we were some of the developments in our economy, notably the decline in manufacturing jobs, started in that period. So I don't disagree with the caller's critique. What I am arguing in the book, and by the way, I don't mind our waking up to a real argument that we need to have. And in fact, this book is trying to sort of suggest what it is we should be arguing about, or a way to have that argument that I hope might be productive in the long run. But I think that if you compare what Ronald Reagan did to what the current generation, a certain kind of conservative, is doing now, the dominant wing of conservatism, it was still less extreme in its anti-government approach. Ronald Reagan raised taxes in order to save Social Security as part of a compromise with Tip O'Neill and the Democrats after he pushed through that budget that the caller didn't like and that I didn't much like either. Ronald Reagan raised taxes, I think it was 11 times, in order to balance the budget. He didn't try to dismantle Medicare. And so in some sense, as conservative as Ronald Reagan was, he still was operating within a kind of consensus. Now, I think our conservative friends are moving beyond that consensus and want to destroy it. And I think what we need to do instead is refresh that balance and that consensus and make it work for a new time.
One thing I want to get at before the hour is out is what is at stake here? There are those who say the political system is broken now. It's already broken, which sort of implies that we can't fix it. But if we go forward and we're not able to reconcile these two facets that you're discussing, community versus individualism, what happens?
Well, I am very worried about having a kind of intellectual gridlock at the heart of government. I mean, we have all kinds of practical reasons why government doesn't work at a particular time. But if we continue to believe, if a large number of people continue to believe that government can't really do much to solve problems, that government is always the problem, I think we're going to have a great problem going forward as a country. I think progressives have been too reluctant to just say outright that they believe in active government. They should also believe in reforming government. They should also believe in making it work. But they actually believe that government can create jobs. For goodness sake, the stimulus, which may not have been big enough, that was passed in 2009, created by most, virtually all objective economists, at least 3.3 million jobs, both directly and indirectly. And so I think once we agree that government really does have an important function to play in building up our country, then we can argue about, you know, should it be a little bigger, a little smaller? How do we pay for it? Which taxes do we have to increase to balance the budget? Because I don't think we can do it all on cuts without, again, eviscerating the useful work that government does. So I think if we cannot have this argument indefinitely, at some point as a country, we're going to have to settle it. And I want it to be settled on the side of balance. And I think in the end, that's where most Americans are going to come down.
And I suppose if we're having an argument about whether or not government is pointless, it's pretty hard to get anything done at the end of the day.
Well, correct. And, you know, why these arguments about the balanced budget, I talk in Our Divided Political Heart about how that debt ceiling fight last summer really made us, I think, severely diminished the view that other countries had of us. I happen to be in England during toward the end of that fight. And it was remarkable. People had always looked up to America and respected us, even when they disagreed with us, sort of looked at us and said, why are you guys doing this? Why can't you? This is not a hugely complicated problem. You've settled budget problems before. Why are you having this enormous fight that's threatening your country's faith and credit? And so I do think it's very damaging if we go on like this, whereas if we could have had a more balanced view that said, you know, we have to raise some taxes, there's some areas we may have to cut, but there are also some areas we have to invest in, particularly the education of the next generation and building up the basic structures of our country. And by the way, one of the fun things of rediscovering the Whigs in this book is Henry Clay didn't use to refer to infrastructure. He referred to internal improvements. And if nothing else, I'd love to get us talking about internal improvements rather than infrastructure. It's a much nicer way to refer to doing the basic things we need to do.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Now we have Bill with us next from Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thank you for the show.
Sure.
Could you comment on the conservatives' embrace of Ayn Rand's objectivism and what I think is its destructive and toxic influence on America's balance between individualism and community? In Wisconsin, Paul Ryan and Ron Johnson have both said they think Atlas Shrugged is one of the greatest books ever written. And I think that goes a long way to what the problems are we have in the state.
I agree with the caller. I am very critical of Ayn Rand's views, too. I'd like to remind people that one of Ayn Rand's books was called The Virtue of Selfishness. I actually have it on my bookshelf at home, not because I agree with it, but because I think it really tells us where this philosophy leads. And I don't think selfishness is the same as defending individual liberty. And I find it very surprising that Rand has gotten this kind of play in conventional politics. I go back to Bill Buckley, the important conservative who really helped create the modern conservative movement. And he was one of the sharpest critics of Ayn Rand on the conservative side. He said, this is not what conservatives believe. That was partly because Buckley was a religious believer and disagreed with Rand's atheism. But he also disagreed with that view of the virtue of selfishness at the heart of her philosophy. So I think the caller is right to use Ayn Rand as a kind of representative and important figure of a turn among conservatives from a more balanced view of their own, even if I had some differences with it, to this quite radical view that I think the more Americans know about how radical it is, I think the more they're going to pull away from it.
Do you think this is a particularly hard battle to fight or an argument to make? Because the strand of American individualism, if you ask people what America is founded on, I think a lot of people would say America is a country of individuals from the time that people came over here to
make new lives in a new country. Those are individualistic people. And it seems that that strand has captured the attention when we look at the narrative more than any other.
You know, Veronica, I wish I could invite you to accompany me on this whole book tour. I have loved the way you've described the book, and I think you've gotten to the heart of the questions that I think I need to answer in making this this argument. Fundamentally, you're right that the simple, right off the top of your head answer that what is it that makes us Americans is liberty, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the very beginning of the Declaration. I think it's only when you look at some of these documents whole, as I say, that's why I like to point out the we at the beginning of the Constitution. It's why I like to point out the end of the Declaration. But when you think about sort of what formed our ideas, it seems to me there were four strands quickly. You know, Ben Franklin kind of individualism, which is about self-improvement. Walt Whitman kind of individualism, which is about self-realization. And then two communitarian strands. And by the way, here I'm drawing on some great work by the sociologist Robert Bella. One communitarian strand is biblical, and the other is small r, republican, that self-rule is not just about serving your own interests. It's about the joy of having the freedom to govern yourself in a way that serves the common interest. Ronald Reagan, everybody remembers, like to refer to us as a shining city on a hill. Well, that came from a sermon by John Winthrop, who talked about how we needed to share each other's joys, feel each other's sorrows, and look upon our obligations to community. He gave that speech in 1630, and I've been thinking as my theme song, as I've talked about this book, the great new Bruce Springsteen song, where the refrain is, wherever this flag is flown, we take care of our own. And I think from John Winthrop in 1630 to Bruce Springsteen in 2012, they're both talking about an essential characteristic of America that I think most Americans understand, even if their first answer to the question you asked at the beginning is liberty. I think they understand this other part of us, and it's one of the best things about us.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones. We can get in one or two more calls maybe before the end of the hour and take Scott joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Veronica, and hello to you, Mr. Dionne. I admire your work. My problem here with what you're espousing is the position that Norm Ornstein is putting out, and it's worse than you think. And the whole idea that what we require to get the changes that you're talking about is for people who are running the system to change a system that's working very well for them right now. Thank you very much. In other words, how do you get money out of politics? I remember hearing a political science professor on Kathleen's program at one point saying, well, one of the problems is people always think that good people go to Washington and get corrupted, but now people who are venal are going to Washington because they know that's where the money is, and if they play the lobby game, they're going to wind up like guy Billy Tozan, wasn't it, from Louisiana, who wound up getting the donut hole Part D Medicare, and then within weeks he went into $1 million a year lobbying post. I might have the details wrong, but you get my drift on this, huh?
No, you're broadly right in what you said about Billy Tozan. First, could I say thank you for what you said at the beginning of the call? That's very kind. Second, I am a fan of Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein's book. I even have a quotation on the back of it. I think they are broadly right in seeing in our politics, asymmetric polarization, that the right and the Republicans have gone farther to the edge than liberals or Democrats have. Indeed, the recent poll by Pew that really looked at polarization in very great detail showed that especially on economic issues, there has been much more movement rightward on the conservative side than movement leftward on the liberal side. Indeed, on some of these questions, liberals have become just a tick more conservative. So I agree with that. The question is, when money dominates and certain people obviously get something out of the current system, can you change it? And the answer is yes. We changed it. The populists rose up. They failed initially, but in alliance with the progressives, they began changing the system. Franklin Roosevelt took office, and he managed to make some fundamental changes in the system. He preserved capitalism, by the way. I think it's one of the great ironies of our history that the people who have preserved the capitalist system tend to be the people who were critical of it and knew that it needed fixing. Capitalism often collapses when its unapologetic supporters refuse to make the changes that need to be made. So that, you know, and I know that neither Tom Mann nor Norm Ornstein are hopeless about this. They too think it can be changed, but we have deeper structural problems now than we have had since, I would argue, that period in the Gilded Age. So it's going to take more work than it might at a normal time. But I don't think it's hopeless. I truly don't think it's hopeless. I think that the system is still at its core democratic, and we just have to find ways of using those liberties we have to change the system.
Well, that's a good note to end on. And EJ, you'll be in Madison on Saturday, June 16th, in a couple of days at 2 o'clock at Barnes & Noble. Have you been to Madison before?
Many times. I haven't been in a while, though, so it'll be a good time to be there. I love Madison.
Great. Well, it'll be fun to have you in town. And thank you so much.
Please show up. And if you just want to ask all the questions, I'll be very happy.
Well, you make it easy. You're a good answerer. So thank you so much. And I wish you well with your book.
Thank you so much.
EJ Dionne, our guest this hour. He is going to be in Madison at Barnes & Noble on Saturday, June 16th at 2 o'clock. And I want to thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and answering your phone calls as well. And also thanks to Brett Jaspers for help producing this week and today as well. If you'd like a copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Today's was 714E. I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.